Like the podcast? Don't just nod along. Join the dialogue. You can support the show or partner with us as a sponsor at www.allamericanypodcast.com. Thanks for being part of a community that still believes that thinking is patriotic.
Stars and stripes. Dumpster fire vibe. Come on. Yourself the American Why.
Hello, excessive thinkers. Welcome back to All American Why. Today's episode is called Why Are We So Obsessed with Heated Rivalry and Will You Come to My Cottage This Summer? Yes, it's a long title, and no, I'm not shortening it. That's what she, he, or they said. A few weeks ago, Connor Story, who plays Ilya Rozanov on Heated Rivalry, hosted Saturday Night Live. In his opening monologue, he joked that the show taught people about hockey and also taught a lot of straight women that their sexuality is actually gay guy. In America, we've wrapped masculinity in dominance. Win at all cost, never flinch, never feel. So when two men are locked in competition, jaw tight, shoulder squared, we're culturally primed to see that intensity as power. But underneath that power is proximity. Eye contact, obsession, emotional fixation disguised as rivalry. I may need a moment here. Just kidding. Here's the twist. Queer representation in America and American media did not begin with heat. It began with restrictions. In the 1910s and 1920s, before strict censorship enforcement, Hollywood's so-called pre-code era was surprisingly fluid. Effeminate men appeared in comedies. Gender bending was a spectacle. In 1919, the German film, different from the others, sympathetically portrayed a gay violinist blackmailed under anti-homosexual laws. Most prints were later destroyed by the Nazis. In 1927, the Best Picture winner, Wings, featured one of the earliest male-on-male kisses in American film. It was brief, but it was there. And in 1930, Marlene Dietrich kissed a woman while wearing a tuxedo in Morocco. That image is still iconic. In 1934, the Motion Picture Production Code hardened into enforcement. Listen, folks, hardened is actually a term people use when referring to regulatory measures. This code explicitly prohibited any inference of sex perversion. That meant homosexuality. Studios complied with the Motion Picture Production Code of 1934 because they feared government censorship and boycotts from the Catholic Church. Queer characters were present. However, when they were, they had to primarily fall into three categories. The coded, the villain, the corpse, or something else. Alfred Hitchcock's Rope in 1948 presented two male killers whose relationship was transparently intimate but never spoken about out loud. In Ben-Hur in 1959, actor Stephen Boyd was directed to play Messala as the former lover of Judah Ben-Hur, though Charlton Heston was not told about this. The subtext was intentional. The text was forbidden. In 1961's The Children's Hour, actress Shirley MacLaine's character confesses her love for another woman, and then unfortunately she hangs herself. For decades, the message was simple. You can be queer, you just cannot be happy. In 1970, the boys in the band put gay men at the center of a mainstream American film. It was raw, messy, self-loathing, funny, bitter. For many viewers, it was the first time they saw themselves reflected. In 1972, a TV show, That Certain Summer, aired on ABC and portrayed a gay father as human and kind. Sponsors hesitated, but it aired. That same year, in 1972, Dog Day Afternoon told the true story of John Wojtowicz, who attempted a bank robbery to fund his partner's gender-affirming surgery. Al Pacino's character is chaotic, but he is not villainized because he's gay. I will be 100% honest with you, I personally haven't seen many of these films or shows, but now that I've done some research, I will look into them, and I encourage you to do the same. From 1972, I'd like to jump to 1985, when Steven Spielberg directed The Color Purple, a movie adapted from Alice Walker's novel, The Color Purple. The film follows Celie, a black woman in the early 20th century American South, who slowly finds her voice and sense of self after years of hardship and abuse. A key part of the story is Celie's relationship with Shug Avery, a bold blues singer who becomes one of the first people to truly see and support her. Their bond is deeply emotional and transformative for Celie. In the film, that relationship is portrayed with tenderness and intimacy, though many have noted that Hollywood softened the more explicitly romantic and physical aspects that were much clearer in the novel. Meanwhile, on NBC, The Golden Girls was quietly doing something pretty remarkable. In the pilot episode in 1985, the women actually had a gay housekeeper named Coco. He only appears in that first episode before the writers drop the character and move Sophia into the house permanently. But think about that for a second. The pilot of a major network sitcom in the Reagan era casually included an openly gay character living in the house. And at that time, that was still unusual. There had been a few earlier examples on television, but they were rare and often treated as very special episodes. Shows like The Soap in the late 1970s had already introduced Jody Dallas, played by Billy Crystal, one of the first recurring gay characters on American television. In the early 1980s, shows like St. Elsewhere and Hill Street Blues occasionally depicted gay characters in one-off storylines, but these were usually serious, issue-based plots about discrimination or tragedy. What made The Golden Girls different was tone. The show treated queer characters as part of everyday life. Blanche's brother Clayton comes out as gay. Dorothy's friend Jean develops feelings for Rose. The women wrestle with their own assumptions, but the show ultimately lands on empathy and acceptance. And then we skip to 1997. Ellen DeGeneres had already built a successful sitcom on ABC called Ellen, where she played Ellen Morgan, a quirky bookstore owner navigating dating, friendships, and life in Los Angeles. The show had already been running for several seasons, but there was constant speculation about DeGeneres' sexuality in the media. In 1997, she decided to address it directly. DeGeneres appeared on the cover of Time magazine with the headline, "Yep, I'm gay." It was one of the most widely discussed magazine covers of the decade. Days later, her character came out on the sitcom in an episode now known as the Puppy Episode. The storyline centers on Ellen accidentally revealing her sexuality into an airport microphone. The episode included appearances by Oprah Winfrey as her therapist and Laura Dern as the woman Ellen begins dating. More than 36 million people watched that episode. Let me repeat, for April 1997, more than 36 million people watched that episode. It was one of the most talked about television events of the 1990s. It also triggered enormous backlash. Conservative groups organized boycotts. Several major advertisers pulled their commercials. ABC added parental advisories before episodes dealing with sexuality. Within a year, the show was canceled. The moment was historic. A lead character on a mainstream network sitcom had come out as gay at the same time the actor playing her came out in real life. This was not just a plot twist. That was cultural rupture. The next year, in 1998, Will and Grace premiered on NBC. The show starred Eric McCormick as Will Truman, a corporate lawyer, and Deborah Messing as his straight best friend, Grace Adler. Sean Hayes played Jack McFarlane, the flamboyant, theatrical friend who often delivered the show's biggest laughs, and Megan Mullally played Karen Walker, Grace's martini-loving assistant. Will and Grace changed the equation. The show was witty, stylish, fast-paced, and structured as a traditional sitcom. Gay characters were not appearing in a single dramatic episode. They were in the center of the story every week. The show ran for 8 seasons in its original run and became one of the most popular comedies on television. Some critics later argued that the characters were softened or framed in ways that made them comfortable for mainstream audiences, but the impact was undeniable. For millions of viewers, Will and Jack were the first gay characters they saw regularly on television, and Will and Jack were not the same. Gay characters or gay people, like all others, are not monolithic. They have variance and dimension. Then in 2005, Ang Lee directed Brokeback Mountain, adapted from Annie Proulx's short story. The film starred Heath Ledger as Ennis Del Mar and Jake Gyllenhaal as Jack Twist, two ranch hands in Wyoming who fall in love while working together one summer herding sheep. The film was widely praised by critics and audiences. It won 3 Academy Awards and was nominated for Best Picture. The film was widely praised by critics and audiences. It won 3 Academy Awards and was nominated for Best Picture. It became one of the most significant films in the history of queer cinema. But the story ended the way many earlier queer stories had ended. Jack Twist dies, and Ennis is left grieving, holding Jack's shirt in a quiet trailer. The message was evolving. Desire was finally visible. In 2004, Showtime premiered The L Word, centering lesbian friendships and relationships with unapologetic sexuality. In 2009, Modern Family gave us Mitchell and Cameron, a married couple raising an adopted daughter in suburban America. Early seasons were cautious about showing them kiss, but they existed as what people call normal. In 2018, Love, Simon became the first major studio gay teen rom-com. Netflix's Heartstopper gave us queer teenage romance built on consent, softness, and mutual care. We were moving away from punishment to tolerance to normalization to joy. Meanwhile, earlier in 1999, Not in America, Russell T. Davies' Queer as Folk aired in the UK, explicit and unapologetic. A North American version was produced in Canada and aired on Showtime in 2000, filmed in Toronto. This show pushed boundaries American broadcast networks would not. And I repeat, it was produced in Canada. Degrassi, another Canadian show, gave us Marco Del Rossi, one of television's first sustained gay teen arcs. Then Schitt's Creek, created by Dan and Eugene Levy, premiered in 2015. In the show, David Rose is pansexual. He falls in love with Patrick. They get married. The town does not revolt. Homophobia is not the central trauma. It is a cottagecore queer storytelling. Soft, earnest, stable. Canada's funding structures allow cultural value to matter alongside commercial return. Britain experiments. Canada normalizes. America scales what proves to be profitable in other areas. Now enter Heated Rivalry. Created by Jacob Tierney and adapted from Rachel Reed's 2019 novel in the Game Changer series, it follows Shane Hollander and Ilya Rozanov across 8 years of professional hockey rivalry and closeted desire. Shane is half Japanese, neurodivergent, hyper-disciplined, and closeted in a league that currently, or as they say, has 0 openly gay players. The show addresses tokenization in sports media. It explores the model minority myth. It portrays the psychological cost of perfection. According to Variety, the series reached an average of 10.6 million viewers per episode in the United States. The finale saw a 300% increase from premiere week. It became the most watched scripted title acquired from another platform in the history of HBO Max. For decades, executives said queer stories were too niche. Apparently, 10.6 million viewers disagreed. And yet, the real NHL, or as some may lead to believe, still has zero gay players. We are comfortable consuming fictional queer hockey. We are still uncomfortable living it. So why rivalry? Competition elevates adrenaline. Adrenaline heightens attraction. Adrenaline heightens attraction. Sports culture allows intense male proximity under the banner of aggression. Romance as a genre has long been dismissed as soft because it centers emotional vulnerability rather than dominance. Heated rivalry merges hockey violence with emotional literacy, tenderness inside testosterone. For over a century, queer characters were punished. Now they were centered, but we still seem to believe desire is most interesting when it hurts. Maybe tenderness feels unfamiliar because American storytelling trained us to equate love with conflict, which brings me to today's guest. Stacey Brewster is an author, screenwriter, creative coach, and workshop facilitator. His debut short story collection, What We Pick Up, explores longing, identity, and the emotional residue of relationships. He and his husband are also friends and neighbors of my husband and me. So today, we are combining cultural history and front porch honesty. After a century of myth-making, are we finally ready for queer love without punishment? Why does rivalry still feel electric? And will we accept an invite to the cottage, figuratively and literally? Stacey, welcome to All American Why. Stacey, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. For those who don't know, Stacey is my friend and my neighbor. And
literally your neighbor.
My favorite heated rivalry obsessed fan.
Honored to be here in the heated rivalry of it all. So
yeah. So first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself. Who are you? What do you do?
My name is Stacey Brewster. I'm an author, a writer, published book of short stories, poetry, screenwriter, film school trained. My W-2 job is I work at the city. I do communications at the city of Portland for the Portland Bureau of Transportation. That's my
PBOT.
Yes, PBOT. So, yeah.
Should I tell them what we?
No, we won't.
People, viewers can figure out what we think PBOT is short for. So, you are obsessed with heated rivalry. So, the question for today is, why are we so obsessed with heated rivalry? Because I'm obsessed as well. And will you come to my cottage this summer?
Gladly. Yeah, gladly. Why are we obsessed? Why am I obsessed?
Yeah.
I guess I'm rejecting the term obsession a little bit. I'm a huge fan. Was since it first came out, just sort of like it hooked me from the beginning. And I describe it as going through a portal for a couple of months, like sort of from the time that, like late November through probably mid-January, I felt like everything was related to heated rivalry. It was my entire personality. I read all six books, and yeah, was following all the threads,
I remember there were videos, there were memes, there were things to buy. Yeah. We went to a hockey game, our first hockey game.
We did go to Pride Night at the Winter Hawks. We did.
There were people fighting, but no kissing. I was kind of disappointed.
And no music from the show, which was also a really, really missed opportunity. We were all ready to dance. Yeah.
So you said you read all the books. Can you tell us about that? What were the books like? Why did you read them?
Well, I tend to be a completist anyway with authors that I like, and especially with any sort of piece of media that I like, I want to read the source material if I can sometimes. So with this, I was like, I just wanted it to keep going on, and rewatching the show, I was like, I kind of just want to know what this world was. Why am I so hooked? Like, tell me, Rachel Reed, like, why am I obsessed with this? For those that don't know, the first book in the series, Game Changers, is the Kip and Scott story. And then the second book, Heated Rivalry, is sort of the main story that's in all six episodes of the show. And then it goes on from there. I don't want to spoil anything for folks that haven't done it. I would say Ilya is a recurring character in all of the books. I've seen it described online that he's sort of like collecting Infinity Stones, and the Infinity Stones are gay hockey players or bi hockey players to bring the camp that he and Shane create. And sort of the idea that they have at the end of the season of the show. And so, yeah, without revealing too much, like the last book, the sixth book, and what Rachel Reed has announced, the seventh book, which will come out. Which will come out next year, like next summer sometime, because she needs more time to write it. She has Parkinson's. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah, this helped pay for her Parkinson's treatment, yeah, right?
It's amazing, the success. And I kept reading the books, not just because I wanted to know what happened to Ilya and Shane, although like that was a motivator. I just wanted to sort of dive in. And I've read some romance. I just wanted to see how it was doing what it was doing, this Rivals to Lovers story. Not all of them are rivals to lovers. Not all of the, obviously, like Kip and Scott, like one's works at a smoothie shop, the other's a hockey player. Not all of them are
both. Extra banana.
You know, two, yeah.
Girl.
Exactly. Girl. And so, yeah, just I love finding the stories. All the books are really well written. They're a lot. So some romance is very spicy. Some of it is more sort of fade to black. Like this sex sort of happens off the page, but you kind of know that it's leading up to that. There's maybe some suggestive language, but Rachel Reed really goes there. It's really, really spicy. And so like that, it was just fun to read, really like hot and sexy to read. So it was fun to read through all these, and all the stories are very different. The characters, she does a really good job of differentiating them.
And the books are spicier than the show?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
a lot more detail, and I mean a lot more body parts than you get in the show itself.
Yeah. So you watched the show six times. You don't ordinarily watch shows six times. So why is that?
I mean, I just wanted to be in the world of the show, and I felt like there was so much to pick up on. I went to film school. Like the cinematography alone was just a conversation. Casting was a conversation. Editing, the music choices. It's just a really skillfully made show. I would recommend it just based on that. If you like good television, it's really good television. Set aside the fact that it was shot in like 30 some days, low budget. Really scrappy production. It's really entertaining for, like, yes, you may be brought in by the promise of some cute boys and sex scenes and all these things, but you're gonna stay for everything else. The writing is really good. The chemistry between the leads is incredible. Mm-hmm. So I mean, just the entire casting, the editing, music, all those things. So
as someone who has written about gay romance, and I think you're also writing more about gay romance, how was this story or the show different from other sort of stories or tropes we've seen?
I feel like it was the whole package. Like, I feel
that's
like
what she or he said.
Michael, you're always good with the puns. No, really, like, I feel like there's all these things that I've liked about, you know, I mean, I enjoyed Heartstopper, like the romance, you know, I mean, is very sweet. The sort of like all that fear and doubt and all that yearning and all that stuff and all that sort of coming out journey. And then there's stuff that's just like queer and subversive and different, which I'm attracted to. And then
like Moonlight, would that be?
Oh, I'm talking about like Pee Wee Herman or
stuff
like media that we consume that's like, you know, maybe from a young age, it's queer coded in some way. It doesn't like have to have even overtly queer.
I always thought Mr. Rogers was really gay. People are going to fight me on that, but
Miss Piggy. I mean, like, yeah, just like a lot of things that were just like queer coded. And then stuff that has intimacy between men, like men figuring out their own shit. Can we curse on this?
Yeah, okay, absolutely. Yeah. Just, unfiltered, please.
Just men working their own shit out amongst themselves and like figuring out, navigating emotions, navigating feelings, yearnings, all that.
It makes me think of like Ted Lasso. Is there a little bit of gay?
Which had some gay storylines later on, which is great. But this, it's like hard to find a show that has all these elements, like all the same. And then I didn't think of it as a queer show at first. Like these are, I don't even think the characters would identify as queer. They sort of eventually identify as gay and bi. But the fact that this is like a sexy romance between two men right in the middle of like dude, bro, masculine, like hockey culture to me is so subversive. Then it's like, okay, well, yeah, this is queer. This is why it has like,
and potentially we're hungry for that because the gay character is the beard or the friend when there's a breakup or
they're comic relief. They're a side character. They're desexualized or oversexualized.
Or you don't see the whole person. You see kind of parts of them. Whereas I think with this, you see more of the whole person. Literally and figuratively, I guess. So, I mean, watching it for six times, did you see things that you didn't see the fifth time or the fourth time? Or
I would say, well, first of all, the first like going through it is tough, especially if you forget that it's a like that there's going to be a happy ending, like the sort of romance tropes. When you're not thinking about that, I think, especially as a queer man, like just, I'm just like waiting for the other shoe to drop. I'm waiting for
like Brokeback Mountain,
just something bad to happen. Just somebody's going to see something. Somebody's going to overhear something. And like, there's just going to be just this really awful moment or violence. Like you just sort of bracing for that.
I was bracing for that. They wouldn't be together or end up happy.
Right, right. All these things. Yeah. You're just like, there's so much tension in that. And the story moves. It's very propulsive. Like the six episodes moves you 10 years in time. Mm-hmm. So even just keeping track of the dates and how long it's been since they've even been able to be together, it kind of just flows over you. And then you get to the final episode, like those last two episodes, which are so emotional and so powerful. And so quiet, especially a lot of moments in that last episode. It's like, yeah, no, I want to do that again. I want to kind of experience that. And kind of now that I know that what's coming, you know, how can I see the way the filmmakers planted the seeds along the way? Like all these little moments that build up to it. And at the same time, I was rereading the books. And so just wanting to kind of see what was different or the same and, you know, how the filmmakers did that. Cause I think Jacob Tierney did an amazing job adapting the books into a structure that worked for television in the amount of time he told it in.
Can you talk more about that? You know, this was done in Canada. Mm-hmm. Potentially this wouldn't have been done in America, or it would have been done in a cleaner, safer way, I guess. Like how does Canada make it so that it is possible?
I honestly can't answer in terms of Canada versus United States, but I know from my work in television, like how many gatekeepers there are in sort of the network and studio and streamer system here in the States. And I'm sure there's some of that to an extent in Canada too, but I don't see this doesn't get greenlit, it seems to me, for any major outlet here without a major star. It doesn't get greenlit without all these things that the algorithm tells you you need.
And some of the actors, they were serving in a restaurant like 4 weeks prior.
Oh yeah. I mean, just the speed, the budget, the casting, like all that stuff would have looked a lot different. And from interviews with Jacob Tierney, the creator and writer and director of all the episodes, it sounded like when they were shopping it around, there was some interest, but it was like, we want to hold off on them even hooking up until the last episode. And that's the hook for the next season. Like, that's how slowly they wanted to tell the arc of the story. It wasn't just that they wanted to tease that. It was just, they didn't get the project at all. And that these two men hooking up, the sex is like, needs to be sort of immediate. And then there's this contrasting of them developing feelings for each other. And it's in those moments in bed that they have a lot of their most intimate conversations, like post-sex, like, okay, now I'm open, I'm vulnerable, and I'm
ready for tuna melt.
I'm telling you what I'm thinking, or I'm actually really uncomfortable and need to leave the room because I'm so overwhelmed that I can't process it. And them working through all of that. You don't get that if all the sex scenes are just, you know, off screen.
Yeah. Or there's a sex scene and then they cut away and that's it.
Yeah.
And also it sounds like they were falling in love or in love. And I think I don't make movies yet, but when we see queer love, I often don't think it's tied to a love story or like the reality of life. It's just very like, it's a meet cute and then they have sex and then that's it. So I think sort of the challenging of like your career and your family and, you know, how this relates to your full day.
I mean, I think one thing the show, and why I say it's a whole package or why it feels new and different, is that so much great queer television, we've had a lot of great queer stories on television. I'm thinking like Pose or Looking or like just like shows that have been out in the last several years.
Will and Grace.
You know, like, and for better or worse, like, you know, L Word has its hit and misses, but it's sort of like addictive in its own way. But it's all based in the community. Like all the characters sort of in this community, and it's there's sort of this opposition to the outside world, and we're seeing some of that contrast. This just seems like these two characters, and we didn't heated rivalry, like Shane and Ilya are like in islands. Like they're the only people that know what each other is going through. And the only one sharing that experience. They haven't built a community of people that, I mean, that's eventually where the show ends up. And the books end up is them like building this camp together and the stuff that is aspirational at the end of the book.
Does it seem like for you, I mean, I know there's been progress made, but in 2026, and I know that it starts out earlier in the show, should we already have queer folks who are part of sports that are, I know this past Winter Olympics, I was really pleased at hearing people talk about their girlfriend or wearing pride pins or, you know, criticizing America, even though they love America. I guess my question for you is, why are we not there yet? Like, why is it a surprise that, why is this refreshing? And then why is this a surprise? Why isn't this just everywhere?
It's straight people's last stand, Michael. You know, it's like, I think queer people are so enmeshed in every form of media and culture, except for sports. Like, that's like the one mainstream entertainment medium. And I'm not a sporty person at all.
Even though football seems incredibly gay, and so do a lot of sports.
It's just like, that is like the last bastion. I think it's why, like, trans issues around sports have been such a hot button topic too. Like, I just think that it's sort of like, I don't know, I'm not a straight person, so I can't imagine what's going through, but it just feels like the gatekeepers, I don't even know that it's sort of the teammates, like I don't feel like it's, and I'm sure it is in plenty of locker rooms, but like it's not necessarily the locker room, it's like the management, it's these league owners, I think those are like a bigger gatekeeper around the money and access that
and
I think is,
they say, just like some people who run countries say, like, oh, we have no gay people here.
Yeah,
and clearly that's not true. On every sports team, I would imagine there's a couple of queer identifying people.
Well, I mean, the amount of people like in the hockey world or sports field that have reached out to Rachel Reed or Jacob Tierney, like just like say how much it means to have this representation and like speaking truth about like their own experience and like all that stuff bottled up
in hopes of meeting the cast.
Well, that could be too, but yeah, just yeah, there's clearly so many more professional players out there that are queer than, and maybe their teammates know, maybe they don't. I mean, that's a lot of stuff that the books deal with a lot too. I mean, these characters end up in some form coming out to various teammates. I mean, these are best friends that, yeah, they've.
You said that sports was like one of the last bastions or the last bastion. Like, why?
I mean, we have marriage. We have military. We have, I mean, just like, yeah. What else? What else is there but sports?
Well, I mean, do you think that this is a trend? I think you and I were talking about this. Like, I'm like, let's gay up everything.
I mean, I think in the romance genre, like, I mean, like, this genre of writing is extremely successful and has been for a really, really long time. So, like, this is not, like, the success of the show is no surprise to romance fans. It's no surprise to the women and queer audiences for that. So, I feel like it's everybody else just catching up to how sort of popular these stories are. And a lot of the romance, especially the rival stuff, will have different sports scenarios. Like there's this one is based in soccer, this one's based in tennis, this one.
So do you think we're gonna venture into that world? I'm excited.
I mean, I think there's gonna be a lot of knockoffs trying to seize on this success. I just don't know that I mean, it depends on the source material and how they handle it. Reed is a good writer.
Yeah.
And she was able to trust. I mean, she was in good hands with Jacob Tierney, who I think, being a gay man, like also brought his own experience and certain things that he shifted in the narrative to sort of like.
It could have gone bad. I mean, we've seen gay movies and shows that are cliche or gaudy, I think would be the word. They're just sort of like,
or the acting's not right, or the like, because you don't see that much sex or it's off screen, like you don't end up seeing the actual attraction or intimacy. I mean, that's part of what keeps me coming back to Heated Rivalry.
Is Connor Story's body?
I mean, that aside, like Connor Story and Hudson Williams both, like the chemistry between those actors as those characters who are very different from those actors as we've seen in the media. Incredible performances, and you really buy the chemistry. You really buy their attraction to one another, their chemistry. You really buy Connor Story as this like broody but joking Russian player.
Yeah,
when
I did.
When I first started the show, or like at saw like and started watching it, like before anything blew up, before there was any media about it, I just assumed they found a
yeah, a I did too. I was shocked to learn that he's from Texas.
Yeah, and no, I mean, yeah. So, I mean, yes, there's going to be knockoffs. There's going to be like other sporty, other rivalry, like romance thing. I mean, people are going to, it's a huge success. Yeah. People are going to want to seize on that.
I mean, I yearn for that, just not this. Like, you know, Andy and I, my husband, will watch a show and I'll be like, are they going to make out? And he's like, no, they're doing a criminal investigation. And I'm like, maybe they'll make out.
Maybe they'll make out.
So, a lot of straight women really like this show. And I think Connor Story said it when he hosted Saturday Night Live. He said,
like, your wives know about the show.
Yeah. And that, like, straight women are realizing they're gay sexual. I think that's what he said. So, like, talk to me. Like, why is it that women see men who are emotionally mature or willing to talk and they don't have that in their life? Like, what do you think the straight woman calling is?
I mean, yeah,
you're not a straight woman.
Full disclosure, I am not a straight woman. I may have, yeah, straight sisters and the like. But, I mean, sexy men talking about their feelings, not committing violence against women, not oppressing women in any way. I mean, like, I think there's a lot to love in that.
Yeah, we met.
And that, I mean, to an extreme, that's like pretty cringy. I mean, there have been stories of like queer people, queer men, like being kicked out of like viewing parties by like the sort of bachelorette extreme crowd that's like there to watch heated rivalry and don't want any men around. So, I mean, that can be taken to an extreme, but I think in its like most sincere form, like there's just a lot of love there.
Nate, who helps us with production, and I went this past weekend to, not to the Winterhawks game, but in the front of it, and we talked to some people about heated rivalry.
Oh, yeah.
And there were some women who were just like, I asked my husband to watch it, and at first he was skeptical, but then he was hooked, and he watched it all with me, and I just think that's so fascinating. I mean,
it's a Rorschach test. I mean, it's like, it's a test. Like, can your straight husband in that instance, like, sit through this love story, like between two men? Like, how is he going to react? Is he going to be like an asshole in the locker room that these players are afraid to, like, if they do something wrong, or if somebody sees the text chain that I'm on,
or he's like, eating ice cream and crying hysterically.
You know, I mean, like, I think it's a great tool to like test your husband. If they're not willing to watch it, or there's something that makes them uncomfortable and they're not willing to talk about what's making them uncomfortable,
or someone you're dating. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like a test. Like, you have the test of how does the person you're with treat service professionals? Like, are they nice to servers and things like that? Mm-hmm. Maybe we have something of like, if someone you like can't watch heated rivalry in a mature way.
Right. I mean, I love that. I mean, just sort of similar to like the Bechdel test or something. Like, you're going to have the HR test. Mm.
What is that? It's like two women are on a screen at the same time.
Talking about men.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they've sort of upped the ante because that seems such a low bar right now. And I don't know that heated rivalry passes the Bechdel test, to full disclosure, but.
I wanted to talk to you more about like media when you were young. Like, what was your like coming to age, or I'll say coming to gay moment of like, you know, was it like John Stamos on Full House? Was it like,
I would say that, I mean, for me, it's a really fraught question. I was born in the late 70s, Gen X. Like, my coming of age, like, is in the era of, like, the height of the AIDS crisis. I think the betrayals that I saw growing up, especially about queer people, queer lives, was sort of tragedy, death. Or it was, like, such an extreme version of what a queer person is, that it was almost like I can't even like pretend to be interested in that, or they're gonna know. I mean, I think there was a lot of sort of like fear and shame, honestly, associated with that. Yeah, I mean, like Chad Allen in Our House, or like River Phoenix when I was growing up, like movies like Stand By Me, or Running on Empty, like these like broody teenage like cute boys. I mean, like, as a broody, you know,
John Cusack, who did it for you?
I mean, like, yeah, or just those awkward moments, like I'm with my grandma watching Thelma and Louise, and there's half naked Brad Pitt, and like, how am I reacting to this in the moment? You know, as a tween. So, I mean, when I talked about heated rivalry earlier, so the whole package, like, I feel like there was all these different things. There was stuff that was queer coded that I was picking up on. There was stuff that maybe I got sort of that intimacy between men but it wasn't a gay relationship. It was, you know, war buddies or like, like those classic like sport films or things like that.
Things always seem more gay to me than they are. And I, you know, I say like gay until proven straight.
Sort of like the brotherhood.
In Portland.
Oh, sure.
But like, that's interesting also because women will like kiss and go to the bathroom in America together and hold hands. And nobody's like, oh, they're lesbians. But in America, not only do you have to hide being queer, it's sort of this constant evaluation of like, are you a man or are you masculine or are you showing gay qualities or feminine qualities? So it's like everything done is sort of watched. I remember being in junior high and it would be like, you know, if you look at your nails like this, you're gay. Mm-hmm, or if your finger is different from this other finger, you're gay. It was just constant.
Or if you have one earring as a dude, like it depends like what earlobe you.
So, I mean, it's interesting because that's when you grow up in that way that like certain factors indicate whether you're queer. And then, you know, that if you identify that way, that either you could be sick when you talk about AIDS crisis, or you're going to be excommunicated, or nobody's going to love you, or you're not presented. We talk about being presented with a generation of elders. We're missing a generation of elders. So I guess talk to me about that. Like, do you feel when you were young as if there were things like heated rivalry for you, or do you feel like not at all?
No, I mean, I don't think there was anything like that when I was growing up. Not that there wasn't gay representation or like characters, but I think that's not what I was seeking out or like even responding to. Like, I sort of the campiness of like Witches of Eastwick, I was responding to, like the drama of Steel Magnolias, I was responding to. And like, you know, I loved musical theater, like, and like ended up doing drama in high school and things like that. So, I mean, there were plenty of signs in terms of like my interest, but like, yeah, no, I was not seeing the sort of works of art or media that was, you know, I wasn't watching Drugstore Cowboy or like any even like older films that had anything close to queer characters or representation.
And you've written about gay culture and queer storytelling before. How do you think that the popularity of this or the way that it was received translates into potentially how you write or are writing?
I mean, it's interesting. I can't help but sort of be influenced, and I'm a big believer. I think I've told you this, sort of content dictates form. So like if I have a idea or story, sometimes it'll come out as a short story, or I keep writing it. It seems like it wants to be something longer, a novella, novel. Sometimes it's a poem. And this just expanded that world for me. Like, I have written romance and like erotica like here and there, but it was kind of just for me, like just like, oh well, like what if I just wrote this like sort of hookup or this sexy thing, or like just experimented with that a little bit. And I've done that, but it was like, oh, that's just for me. Like I'm not gonna try and publish that. Like, I think I placed up my own like level of stigma on what a lot of people do around the romance genre. Like that's lesser than, that's like, that's not literary fiction, that's over here. And you know, to my own detriment, I mean, it's a very successful genre. I mentioned having a W-2 job. Maybe I would be self-employed as a writer if I was writing more romance. So I did, it is inspiring. And I have read some romance, but I've been reading a lot of romance since Heated Rivalry, not just the Heated Rivalry series, but other books, just sort of experiment, see what's out there, what's spicy, what's not spicy, what's sort of like on the page, off the page, friends to lovers.
Is there a gay baseball one?
I'm pretty sure there is.
I need that in my life.
I'm pretty sure. I know there's a tennis one coming out like in the next couple of months called The Open Era that people are looking forward to. There's one called Futbolista that's about a couple of soccer players that I'm really interested in reading because I've read another romance by that I think Andy and Santo is the other romance by that author. And that's sort of more of a friends to lovers, where the tension is not because they hate each other or they're competing in some way, but it's sort of, they're so close to each other and don't want to lose that friendship. And now it's developing into something more. And what do they do with those feelings? And if they don't want to lose the friendship, that's really enticing.
So too. It seems like you're excited by this genre and want to partake in it.
It's fun. I mean, I was even thinking like, okay, what if I wrote a romance version of the novel that I've been working on and just sort of like experiment with what that would look like. And not that there's not sex in my novel, but if I take myself out of the headspace of this is like, this has to be literary fiction, with just like, this just needs to be a good story, with interesting characters and good writing, then I can sort of put the genre a little bit further back of the head. So it has allowed me to sort of experiment a little bit in my writing. So that's fun.
If someone listening has never read or watched Heated Rivalry, what would you say to them?
Why? do I need to get you a trial HBO Max subscription? No. How would I describe it to them? Or
what would you say to convince them to give it a try, to watch it? They say, oh, I've been hearing about this gay show, hockey.
I mean, put everything else aside, it's good television. Like, it's six episodes. Like, it's really good television. It's really compelling. Like, yes, there's sex in it, but there's, like, these great characters, really great writing.
Soundtrack's good.
The soundtrack's fun. It's really propulsive. The editing's great. The cinematography is really incredible. It's really good television. I mean, we've been in this, like, peak television era, and, like, if you're going to spend 12, 13 hours binge watching X show, like, why not spend a few hours with this one? It's really worth it. It's worth your time.
So if you had to sum up
why... It makes you feel good. I mean, come on.
If you had to sum up why you're a fan...
Why do you not want to feel good? That's what I would say to them.
Right? if you had to sum up, you know, we didn't want to use the word obsessed. If you're a fan... What would you be like? Why is this different? Why are we doing an episode of Heat? I mean, I chose to do an episode about Heat Rivalry, but like, why are you watching a show six times and reading all the books?
I mean, I've not been this, and I will use the term obsessed, like this, like deep into a TV show since Twin Peaks.
I was just going to say, it's my guess.
That I was completely obsessed with that show. It was just so weird and different than anything that was on television at the time. David Lynch, I just all the characters, just the mystery of it all. So enthralled. And it inspired so many like TV creators and so much that has happened since. I mean, you sort of laid the groundwork, and it'll be curious to see like sort of the legs of Heated Rivalry and what it inspires down the line.
Yeah.
Sort of like breaking up the genre. But I was kept thinking about Twin Peaks because I was like, oh my God, I've not been like rewatched a show in this way since. And now I've completely forgot the question because now you've touched on two of my obsessions.
Just the why is this different? I mean, that's
it touches on I mean, at the center of it, it's just a really human story. Like someone figuring out who they are and who they're in love with and all the conflict that may come with that when you're a superstar in a world that's really dominated by our culture, straightness, like all these boxes that these characters are put in, Russian culture for the character of Ilya, all these things and all these pressures. So yeah, it's just, I mean, is that cheesy to just say it's a really human story?
No, but yeah, no, I don't think so. Yeah.
I mean, yes, it's fantasy. Like, it's like, you know, all these things that you can sort of genres you can put on it, romance, fantasy, all these things. But at the end of the day, like, don't we all want to live in the cottage? Like, don't we all just want that experience that these characters have by the end of that? And there's so much more to come. Mm-hmm. Like, the level of like hope and joy that this brought in this time was not escapism for me. Mm-hmm. I was like fully aware of everything that was happening in the world and the news, all the challenges that we're facing, but you need like some way to get out of that sometimes and have a different perspective. Like, oh, we can have something else. There is something else possible. So yeah, that was that for me, especially in this like intense period, I would say 2.5 months, which I think I'm up to 7 or 8 times through the whole.
7 or 8 show. Times. Yeah, it's more than 6 times.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. I don't think I it's probably been a good solid month.
Can you speak to, you know, you talked about there is possibilities, there's happiness. Loved the scene of kissing on the ice, of course, but I also really loved the mom when Shane's mom is supportive. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what did having a parent express support in that way mean in the show for you?
I think Shane's reaction in that moment is very relatable, like sort of that sort of internalized shame, like I wanted to do better for you, like I really tried, you know. He says like, you know, I really really tried to not be this other thing that seemed wrong, or you know, whatever. And I think what was so powerful about that scene is what his mother Yuna says is like, no, I'm apologizing to you, like I'm apologizing to you for making you feel like you couldn't come to me with this, and like, will you forgive me? I mean, like, I'm choking up just like saying because it's like we don't hear that from in our coming out stories. Few of us do. I didn't, you know. It was sort of like, okay, now
you're burdening or inconveniencing or making it so you have to explain.
I mean, I like my coming out was like, this was my burden, now it's yours. Like, if you have an issue with it, that's your issue. Like I'm good with who I am, and like
everyone else can fuck off.
Yes, so like that's your issue, that's not my issue, that's yours. And there was like a mother like, no, like I like not only like I'm in this with you, but like I see now that I may have put so much pressure on you to be this one way. Cause she's his man in the show. For those who haven't seen it, she's also his manager. So she's handling all these like big deals with Rolex and all this stuff. Like, she's producing this character, this like superstar that is her son, her only son, and sort of losing sight of like, oh, I mean, she even says like, oh, we kind of thought like maybe you were gay, just like, but like you don't breach that with your son, or just like make them know that like,
yeah, or you can't be gay because you're a hockey player, like the world,
right? Like it's sort of like understood from everything, like that's just not something that's done. There are no out gay players, which is why the kiss on the ice that you're talking about like ends up being so powerful. They use that so well to parallel the two stories, and like that's what opens the world up for them, like.
See, I start getting teary-eyed just thinking about it as well. Okay, so we're up to the final segment.
And the Wolf Parade song, which, like, Jacob Tierney cleared, like, way before ever shooting that, because everything was planned around that scene. And
that is a really good song. Yeah. Okay, we're up to the final segment, which is, why is it like this? So, why is it like this? Basically, you can complain about a thing, a person, a place. Mine, I'll go first. Mine today is people who are talking to you while you go pee. So why is it a thing? So, you know, you go pee, and whether you're in a urinal or a trough, which I absolutely hate, and there's a bar and a trough,
horrible.
Or they see you going into a stall and someone's having a full-on conversation with you. You know, it's not just like, hey, or I'll see you later, or I'll see you back out there. It's like someone's talking about your family or your life or your job. And I'm like, I'm trying to go to the bathroom. Can you not have a conversation with me? And then also, like, what are they expecting? Like, am I supposed to turn around and make eye contact? Do I give you a career update? Like, what, like, what is the, this isn't,
are we comparing?
Yeah. Like, what's, I mean, happening? It's not a networking mixer. It's a bathroom.
I mean, is it like the confident people, or is it like the anxious people that are like so uncomfortable with with going to the bathroom being vulnerable that they have to fill
the space? I think it's both. Yeah, I think it's both. I think there's the guy who talks to everybody and has a conversation, and then I think the guy who's completely awkward thinks that he has to talk because of you being in proximity. And I'm like, you do your thing, I do my thing. And maybe we'll talk when we're washing hands, or maybe we'll talk outside, but don't have a full conversation with me when I'm trying to go pee. So that's my, why is it like this?
It's just an age old question, Michael.
Yeah. So what is your, why is it like this?
My, why is it like this? Why do bosses and managers exist? And why do they hate telework so much? Why is it like this? I want to know. Mostly for my union, but also like in general, there have been so many studies, especially during the pandemic. So many people started working from home. Suddenly they felt safer. They were healthier. Like all of their outcomes, they were more productive. They took less sick days. Mm-hmm. They like led to companies like keeping people longer, like better retention, all these things. And then there was just this like maniacal push to get everybody back to return in person, like full time, as though that like just forget that COVID ever happened or that any work ever happened.
Well, if you present that you don't trust someone or you're watching them, why would they want to be more loyal or work harder for you? The lights just went out.
So I think the bosses are listening. So yeah, I'm going to go to my safe house now.
The bosses of yesteryear.
It's just, yeah.
Hello. That has 100% power, so I'm a little concerned.
Yeah. What's going on? What happened? Where were you when the lights went out?
I think we're good recording, yeah? Did we get the last part?
Yeah, we'll keep going. You don't plug it in.
Can I complain about bosses more?
Yeah, please do.
It's 0% charge.
They will not cut together.
So you said bosses and managers, period, plus they don't like telework?
Yes, yes. They seem to exist only to hate telework.
I see.
And to get in the way of people doing work at all.
Yeah.
That's the main complaint that I hear. I'm a union steward, and we can wait to talk about this until they're all set up.
Please don't. Please let me record.
It's gonna be an interesting editing. Yeah, it'll be part of it. Okay. Well, why is it like this?
How the sausage is made.
Why would a boss not want you to telework? Is it because they're working in the office as well and they're lonely? Is it because they want to make sure you're not doing fun things during the work hour?
I think it's a sign of a really insecure manager.
You can talk about things like people who track their mouses too.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, all that.
Or they're like in your screen AI as you're doing tools work.
To like, yeah, count keystrokes and all that stuff.
Yeah. I did restaurant work for like 10 years. One time I had a restaurant job, this was in San Diego, where my bosses wouldn't be in, but they would have a camera and they would like watch me on camera. And then like if I gave like an extra iced tea refill or whatever it was, they would call me on the phone and be like, you're giving that lady too much iced tea.
Well, this is happening in fast food where I can't remember if it was Carl's Jr., one of the major like fast food chains where they're having headsets and there's AI in their headset like correcting them the way they're talking to customers. Really? So they say something to a customer and then the AI may say like, oh, try to be friendlier next time. You know, I have no idea what it says. It says like talk to them better. You know, I don't know what the voice.
May I ask you which hot sauce you'd like with your crunchier app supreme?
But it's just like how creepy. I mean, it's just very like master on the plantation vibes is what it gives me. Like if I don't see you working, then like you're stealing from whatever this is. There's just the lack of trust and the insecurity of management. I'm experiencing this a lot as a union steward where a lot more people are coming like, oh, my manager's really like just above and beyond like micromanaging.
Asking what I'm doing feeling all day.
Like this lack of control because at the city of Portland, the mayor sort of required all managers and supervisors to come back full time in person. Mm-hmm. But the rest of us that don't, where our jobs don't require in-person work, are still sort of half-time. Mm-hmm. So a lot of us have telework agreements to work, you know, X days from home, or like me with neuropathy and some other issues going on, mm-hmm. I have an ADA exemption to work fully mm-hmm. remotely. But I get 3 to 4 times more work done from home than when I go into the office. Everybody's yeah. chatting. We're in these.
Well, that's the thing, is shouldn't productivity dictate that? Like, if the person's doing their job, why would you have to watch them if they're doing a good job and they're doing the job that they're hired for? Like, I don't understand.
There's some mentality, and I think you're handed this mentality when you become a manager, especially if you're already an insecure person. And I think we're seeing now that it's been almost a year that supervisors have been back full time. They're like feeling like my workers have more rights than I do, basically, and they're resentful. Yeah. And they're lashing out in ways that are sort of not great.
Got it. What's interesting about COVID is there's a long list of things that I thought we learned, and then we immediately
decided they didn't happen.
Yeah, so like we learned that healthcare shouldn't be tied to employment. I mean, we already knew that, but even more so, we mm-hmm. learned that people who are contractors or business owners who haven't hired themselves, they don't pay into the unemployment fund. So if you have a contractor or freelancer who's unemployed, they have no unemployment. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. the state had to do a special pandemic unemployment fund. So it's like there's things like that.
From heated rivalry to unemployment fund.
And everything in between.
From the cottage yeah. to everything yeah. in between. Yeah.
Maybe the answer is to get sponsorships. We need to be sponsored.
Yeah. It's just wild. It's just a unique time as we're still recovering from the pandemic. We still haven't really sort of grappled with all the grief and everything that we lost as part of that. And I mean, on top of the shit show that is the world right now, mm-hmm.
including people who passed, I thought there would be more of a collective memorial or memory. It's as if nobody died and nothing happened.
And I think the history of the Spanish flu was very similar, where they didn't they just kind of moved on. like, okay, that happened and we're not talking about it anymore.
Interesting. What a time.
That doesn't seem healthy.
It doesn't seem healthy.
Like, you know, straight hockey culture where they don't talk about their feelings. They just fight things.
Yeah. You know what doesn't seem healthy is taking vaccine advice from your neighbor. Not you, but a different neighbor.
Uh-oh.
Well, I think
the neighborhood signal's about to get really strange.
We have a really great neighborhood and a really great signal chat, so I feel blessed in that regard. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Great to see you, and I'll see you around the neighborhood.
I'll see you across the street.
Well, we've reached the end of this episode of All American Why. If you made it this far, congratulations. You're officially an excessive thinker too. If something today made you laugh, cringe, or reconsider everything you thought you understood about this country, good. That's the point. Subscribe, rate, review, and share All American Why wherever you get your podcasts, including on YouTube. Or don't. It's still a free country for now. You can find me, Michael Jonas, on social media or at allamericanwhy.com. where we're building community for people who still give a damn. All American Why is filmed and recorded at X-Ray FM Studios in North Portland, Oregon. Original music by Renezra and Views. Audio editing by Kyle Gilmore of Residual Audio. Until next time, keep your curiosity loud, your optimism spiteful, and your democracy under constant surveillance. This is All American Why. Thank you for listening.
All American why? All American why? All American why? Ask yourself the American why.
Hey everybody, it's Michael, host of All American Why. I'm out front of a Winterhawks game at the Veterans Memorial Coliseum, talking to folks about heated rivalry. I have with me
Lindsay,
Lacey,
Leslie,
Natalie,
Kayla,
Katie.
Did you watch all the episodes of Heated Rivalry?
Yes, very much so.
Many times.
And why did you like it?
They're so hot.
And every time I have told someone to watch this show, I say, okay, just be with an open mind because I never knew I was going to be so into this.
The connection between Ilya and Shane. Yes, very much so.
Many times.
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah. Like the whole relationship dynamic was amazing to watch. Not just with like the main characters, but like the entire show, everybody else, like, it, yeah, we were hooked immediately.
Yeah. It's so well made. There are parts of the characters that I relate to. It's like a fantastic representation in a bunch of different directions.
Also, if I'm allowed to say this, it made me love my husband so much.
Is that because he is emotionally intelligent?
Very hot, regardless of the sex that you're into.
Yeah.
And did you already like hockey, or did the show help you become hockey fans?
I love ice skating. Yeah, that's yes. I mean, I always wanted to come to a game, but this forced me to be like, we have to go.
This is my first hockey game, so we'll see.
Yeah, we'll get back to you.
Yeah, we're here for the fighting and the kissing.
And some blood.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite character in Heated Rivalry and why?
I want to say Ilya, but mainly because that actor is just phenomenal.
I'm like, Ilya, because he's funny and he's hot.
Yes.
Yeah, Connor's character. So I love him. Like
Colander. Take me to the cottage.
No, I am frozen off immediately.
Kip! Sorry.
Girl.
Hope you have a good night. Thank you so much. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Like what you're hearing? Back it, build it, be part of it. Support the show or sponsor an episode at www.allamericanypodcast.com. And thank you for thinking with us.